The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
And you're tuned now with the Space Show. And welcome to The Space Show, the program with plenty of spunk, presented at this time every week by the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control tonight we have Alan Walker. And on tonight's Space Show, yes, spunk, floating fertility, we have a story about what NASA's doing to study the effects of zero gravity and spaceflight on sperm. And we're also going to be meeting someone else, Tony Myers, part three of our ongoing series. Their final part tonight, Tony Myers, who produces the IMAX space movies. Her latest movie, Space Station 3D, is showing in town. But before we start into our first segment on Tony Myers, we'll just hear this announcement.
Hi, I'm Andrew Gaze with a quick time out for you to think about nominating a teacher for NEETA, the National Excellence in Teaching Awards. If you're a student or a class or a kinder parent and you've got three reasons for supporting a great teacher, you can nominate them today. Contact your local school or preschool for a nomination form, or just ring NEETA information line. The number is free call 1800 624 487.
And on tonight's Space Show, we're going to have the major part of the show devoted to the work of Tony Myers. Now, this is the final in three discussions we've had with Tony, and Tony is the writer and producer of the currently screening Space Station 3D IMAX movie. Now, before Space Station 3D, she produced a string of space-related IMAX films. Now, Tony's been with IMAX, the Canadian large-screen cinema company, since its inception. Her career has taken her from pop video to space movies. This gentlewoman has been able to persuade NASA to fly her cameras and engage the services of the astronauts and cinematographers, or as cinematographers. The results have been absolutely stunning. Her films give audiences an experience they will never forget. This is the closest one can get to flying in space without actually doing so. Here then is our third chat with Tony Myers and our sampling of her work.
The Dream is Alive was created expressly for the IMAX motion picture system. The Los Angeles Times called the film breathtaking, the coming of age of the ultra-large screen format. Giant or dome-shaped IMAX screens occupy most of the audience's field of view. The IMAX experience extends this view to the edge of peripheral vision, and the audience feels it is part of the picture. The large film frame creates an extraordinary sharpness and clarity of the IMAX image. Six-track stereophonic sound surrounds the audience and completes the illusion of being at the center of the action. Theaters designed specifically for the IMAX motion picture system give everyone an unobstructed view of the screen. Unlike television, the more measured pace allows the eye to appreciate fully the detail and grandeur of the image. For those who have seen The Dream is Alive in an IMAX theater, this video will serve as a perfect souvenir. For those who have yet to see the film, it is a tantalizing introduction to the remarkable IMAX experience.
I've had a question from some of the students at the McRobertson Girls High School about Tom Cruise. He, does, of course, does the narration on this new movie. What was it like to work with him?
I can tell you that working with Tom Cruise was an absolute privilege and a delight and lots of fun. As you have been no doubt reading and hearing, he is a great space enthusiast. But he's also an accomplished pilot himself. He's a jet pilot. He's a deep-sea diver. He's an explorer. And he, we took him prior to our recording. We took him on a tour of the Johnson Space Center, and he flew all the simulators. He The astronauts told me afterwards that he had more questions than they knew how to answer. He is very serious about space. He's not a dilettante. He's really, really interested. And as such, that made him a fantastic narrator for the film and a really good fit, because I think what he does, when you hear him, you'll see that he kind of stands in for all of us who can't go into space. So he is radiating his own personal enthusiasm in his performance in the film, and it's very infectious. And I feel just so glad and happy that we were able to work together. It was really a great thing.
You've mentioned a few things that are in this new movie, Space Station 3D. What are some of the other things we can expect to see?
Well, as I mentioned, we have two cameras, one that lived inside the space shuttle, space station for 337 days. And what that camera lets us do is fly through the station and explore its architecture alongside the crews that live there. It lets us shave and take a shower and pack and unpack, equip a lab, see views out the window, all manner of fun things inside the space station. It acquaints us with the early science that is being done there, the human resource facility coming into the lab, and some of the other experiments that were being installed at that time. The cargo bay camera, which flies up and down in the shuttle's cargo bay, that camera is positioned in different places in the cargo bay depending on what we're shooting. And what that shows you is the exterior construction with spacewalkers. We have three different lenses, so you feel that you're right there on the edge of the structure as they're deploying antennas and hooking up the fluid cables. And what it really gives you, though, is an insight into how complex an engineering feat it really is. The detail is absolutely stunning when you see it. It's so hard to describe to people who haven't seen it, and people who have come away utterly in awe. And I think that you'll also find that you have lots of fun on the space station. There are lots of musical sequences, many faces coming and going, because the way that a space station is built is many rotating crews and many shuttle crews that come to visit. So it's a constant flux of different people. A very important aspect of it is the quilt of different nationalities that are participating. It's not called the International Space Station for nothing. It's, of course, a collaboration of 16 different nations, which is an enormous achievement in itself. And we have we feature astronauts from Canada, from Russia, from Italy, from Spain, from America, from Japan. They're all in there, and you hear them on the soundtrack talking about what it means to them to have finally come together in space, and it's a very inspiring thing.
We have already taken the first small steps outside our planet. We designed this shuttlecraft to carry people and cargo up into orbit. Here, far above the Earth's atmosphere, we're learning how to live and work in space.
Strike, you gotta go one way over the other.
Okay, it's doing a nose sweep, going towards the starboard side.
The exterior shows just a little of the expected wear and tear of many trips back and forth. The shuttle is equipped with a robotic arm to move large payloads ferried up from Earth.
Houston, do we have a go for Spa's maneuver to release attitude?
It has lifted from the cargo bay a spacecraft which carries a German telescope named Orpheus and a remotely operated IMAX camera. Through its lens, we're seeing as never before the exterior of the shuttle as it orbits the Earth.
Discovery Houston, you have a go for Mars release.
Copy that.
Now, the Orpheus telescope has been released into orbit. We are riding with it, floating free in space. Beneath us, the shuttle pulls away, its cargo bay empty. Orpheus will spend several days observing the hottest and coldest gases in our galaxy. Then the shuttle will take it back to Earth. Over three decades, we've learned how to travel back and forth to space and live in low Earth orbit. Now that we've taken these first steps, are we ready to cross the great black void to explore the other worlds in our solar system? The journey will be hundreds of times farther.
Well, Canada itself has, of course, got a very big part in the space program. They built their Canada arm and now the Canada arm 2, which is on the space station. Have you had any work with the Canadian Space Agency?
Well, yes, we certainly have Marc Garneau, who we flew with, is now, of course, president of the Canadian Space Agency. We covered the installation of the SSRMS, that's the station's robotic arm, which is a heavier sister or brother to the original robotic arm that flies up and down on the shuttle. And so that is featured in the film. It, of course, was first used to install the station's airlock, which enables the EVA crews to actually do their spacewalks from the station rather than having to go out through the, when the shuttle is docked, through the shuttle's airlock. So.
And how did you, a Canadian, get involved in filming the American space program?
Well, I became involved because we, as IMAX, is a Canadian company. No, let me do that again, if I may. IMAX was originally a Canadian company, and that is how I came to work with Graham Ferguson and Bill Shaw and Roman Kreuter and the original founders of it. We made a film in 1981. This was before any space cameras were built, called Hail Columbia. And we thought space would be a wonderful subject matter for IMAX, and we wanted to convince NASA that we could fly a camera in space. And so Graham made Hail Columbia. NASA didn't know who the heck IMAX was, would barely give us press accreditation to film launches. It was quite a battle then to even get close to a shuttle launch, and let alone go into space, which we weren't trying to do at that time.
Graham, welcome back. Hail Columbia. This is Susie. Best thing that ever happened to me. It was a really tremendous mission from start to finish. Crippen is one of the hardest workers I know, and he carried me through that whole thing. I think we've got a fantastic and remarkable capability here. We're really not too far, the human race isn't, from going to the stars.
You know, when you ride a launch vehicle, the future standard launch vehicle of the United States of America, if it doesn't work right, if all those engines doesn't work right, you don't get very far downrange. Well, the space shuttle worked perfectly. It was a beautiful thing. We really have something here. I saw a newspaper headline that expressed it far better than I could. It showed the space shuttle orbiter, and it said that the dream is alive again. Let's keep it that way.
I'll backtrack a little bit and tell you an interesting story, is that when we very early days put a theater into the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, that was in 1976, I believe, and the first director of the National Air and Space Museum was Michael Collins, Apollo 11 astronaut. And, of course, he was the person who was piloting the command module in orbit around while Aldrin and Armstrong took those first steps. And when Michael Collins saw the IMAX technology, he said, this is the camera that has to fly in space, because it's the only thing I have ever seen that begins to convey what we actually experience. Well, we heard that loud and clear, but we didn't know if anybody else had. And it actually took 10 years from the time he made that statement until we actually got a camera into space for Dream is Alive, and that was the...
Before joining IMAX, I believe you worked with the BBC in London.
Well, I've traveled all over the place. After first working with Graham Ferguson, the co-founder of IMAX in Expo 67, I migrated over to England, and during that time the invention of IMAX was proceeding and all the testing, and I got working there, working for the BBC, working on various rock and roll films. It was the 60s. I did a lot of work for Apple and John and Yoko, many films with them. And in the middle of all that, Graham was doing the first all IMAX film for Ontario Place, and happily invited me back to edit that. So I came back to Canada to do that, then went back to England. So I did a lot of IMAX, early IMAX films, interspersed with the rest of my work, which was in England. My husband was there, and my family was born there. So,
what were the Beatles like to work with?
Well, primarily, as I said, I worked with Yoko and John, and they were highly experimental filmmakers in their own right. And Yoko, of course, is a had been a conceptual artist and still is from the very early 60s. And so it was a real pleasure to work with them, because there were a lot of new ideas. And the little company that my husband and some partners and I had back then, we were the pioneers of rock videos. They weren't videos then. We were doing Top of the Pops, which was a BBC hit parade program, and we were the first to make little films to go with the records. And we became the company that people came to then. And so we did all kinds of rock and roll concerts and everything, and that led... people started coming to us, and among them John and Yoko. So I edited a number of films for them, and just to close that loop, only March 31st I had a reunion after 32 years with Yoko, because she was having a retrospective of all her artwork at the Art Gallery of Toronto. And she was coming to Toronto, and I hooked up with her, and we were able to say hello after all that time. So it was fun.
And did that work in the pop field help you with the film that you made with the Rolling Stones?
Absolutely. Going back to, that was cut to 1991. I think that was when that film was made. And yes, that was just like stepping into a comfortable pair of slippers working on that film. And that was very similar to the way we used to actually shoot concert films, except with not as much film as you would in 16 millimeter because of the expensive resources. But we had multiple cameras. We had 8 cameras, and it was a very similar kind of way of piecing it together. My job on that was to kind of supervise the editing, and that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
was the film you had the most fun with? And perhaps, alternatively, what film has given you the most satisfaction?
Well, this is a very good question. I think I've done a lot of different kinds of films over many, many years, some dramas, some documentaries. They're all completely different. I have to say that Space Station 3D is really the pinnacle for me in terms of what we started off planning, what our expectations were, and how it's actually come out. I think meeting and having the opportunity to train 9 different crews full of absolutely extraordinary people. All of the space shuttle crews we've trained for all of our films have been wonderful. There hasn't been one that isn't. But somehow it was the mixture of people, the different nationalities of people, and what that brings to the mix is really inspiring. And it gives you hope for the future of the planet because, you know, it's one small thing. But if there's more thinking, cooperative thinking like that, it will do us all a world of good.
First, we need to understand how we adapt to weightlessness. Connected by tunnel to the crew cabin, a laboratory known as Space Lab is carried in the cargo bay on certain flights. Inside it, scientists are performing experiments developed by 13 different countries.
Okay, get going there. Here's Bobby.
2 medical doctors, Norm Thagard and Roberta Bondar, a Canadian, are studying how our sensory systems behave when introduced to microgravity. More than half the astronauts experience space motion sickness the first day or two. German payload specialist Ulf Merbold is conducting an experiment to find out more about how it happens.
I've got Vexen.
The subject sees one thing, but he feels another. His brain is confused by these conflicting messages, and he becomes disoriented.
Is the spacecraft? It's only early days in the construction of the space station, and it's going to get a lot bigger and a lot more complex. Is there any chance that you'll update the film at some point?
You know, it's a very good question you ask. We've often been asked about updating films. Our film Destiny in Space, for instance, charted the initial deploy of the Hubble Space Telescope and then its subsequent repair. And people, I've often thought, well, gee, we ought to update it because at the time we released the movie, we were just getting the very first images back from the improved Hubble, which was... I think in the Horsehead Nebula, maybe one of those, it was the first kind of proof that there were planets around other stars. And, you know, an updated film just doesn't pull people in. You kind of really, you can't tack sort of a chapter on the end of an old film. It's somehow... recycling it and isn't fair to the audience and isn't fair to the film. So I think it's better to think harder, work a bit harder, and try to invent a new idea to convey new information. And Blue Planet is the same. I mean, if you think of most of the themes in that, most of the predictions and discussions are ongoing and will be for many, many years to come in terms of global warming and all of the things that are happening to the planet. But I think that we generations change so rapidly. I think you have to have a new and fresh approach on the same subject every time you step up to do something.
You shoot a lot more film in space than you actually get to use in the movies. And perhaps not everything goes according to plan. Is there any chance, like they do with some other movies, a sort of a bloopers film or DVD?
Well, there are, as I think I said earlier, there's no take two on orbit. So one thing I didn't actually say, and this is a serious answer, I didn't explain that when we redesigned the cameras for space, we couldn't fly a two-strip camera. We had to fly a one-strip camera. Normally our ground cameras are a left eye and a right eye. Two strips of film, which is what makes them so large. They're projected with two strips of film. In order to fit in the mid-deck locker of the shuttle, we had to compress the camera into a one-strip system. That goes twice as fast and gives you half the yield. And so the film is going through there at 11 feet a second, more than 11 feet a second. And a roll the size of a family pizza, 1,220 feet, is gone in 108 seconds. So that gives you about three shots before they have to keep changing. So those crews did not mess around. They did not waste any film at all. So when I say there's no bloopers, there aren't really bloopers, but every little thing that was interesting to look at made its way into the film in some way or another. And I'll tell you an interesting story in that I had just finished supporting a mission. That means we're in mission control throughout the filming in case anything goes wrong with the camera. And usually the crew is up the opposite time to what you are. So you're having to wake up at 11 o'clock at night and work through till 11 in the morning with them. And I'd come off 2 weeks of being on this opposite time, and I'd gone to visit a friend for a couple of days before coming back to Houston. And nobody knew that I was there. I was just recovering. And my cell phone rang on the second day I was there at 7 in the morning. And I was kind of really cranky about this. And I said, who is calling me on this number? Snatched the phone up off the kitchen table, kind of barked into it. Hi, this is Jim Voss. I'm calling you from the space station. I'm not kidding. And they had, on that second increment, that crew had little Cisco, they're not really telephones. They're a little hookup that plugs in, that reaches, goes via satellite. It's on their laptop computers. And they were having, at the time of their lives, dialing their friends. Normally you can't speak directly to the crews, as you know. You have to go through the NASA hierarchy of only the CAPCOM, another astronaut, can speak directly to the shuttle crews. But in this case, they were allowed to call their families and friends, and I had no idea this call was coming. So Jim had just called to chat about what he'd been shooting on orbit. And one of the things he said at the end of that was that we also shot you 6 seconds of aliens. That's it. So those 6 seconds of aliens are in the film. That's all I'll tell you.
Okay, so what's next for you then?
We have a couple of projects that we're just beginning to develop now. This project itself was about 4.5 years from beginning to end, and so we haven't had a breather, nor much time to really develop other projects, so we're just beginning to work on those now. One, of course, is another space film, and another one is possibly about a hurricane.
There's still one more hurdle, the most important one of all. Columbia returns to the Kennedy Space Center to prove that it can do what it was designed to do, to go up again into space. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tony, for joining us on the Space Show.
It's been a great pleasure, and I hope that everybody will come out and see the Space Station 3D. It's at the Melbourne Theatre opening on the 13th of June, and I guarantee it'll take you to Space Station.
Thank you.
That's all right. That was excellent.
Tony Meyer's latest film, Space Station 3D, is now currently screening at the IMAX Cinema in Rathdown Street, Carlton. And what do Melbourne audiences think of this new movie? Well, the Space Show caught their reactions as they emerged from the first screenings.
Okay, what do you think of the film?
I loved it, yeah. If it wasn't 3D, it wouldn't have been the same film.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was really amazing.
And what was the highlight for you?
The goggles.
So, what did I think? I found the scene where the dust hits the eyes, that was remarkable.
Yeah, it was a spectacular film, really good. Definitely recommend it.
Cheesy American lines.
I'm with Robin Hirst from the Melbourne Museum. What did you think of it, Robin?
I thought it was sensational. I thought we were right there with them every moment of the day, whether you're eating, sleeping, in orbit. It was just spectacular, I thought. Amazing, yeah.
Have you seen any of the other space movies?
I have. I've seen most of them from A Dream Is Alive through, but I thought that was the best. I mean, I really thought we were there with them. It was a sensational view, yeah.
Was there any particular highlight?
A particular highlight? No, I think just the humanity, actually, the way they were clowning around in space. I mean, from the high, even though all the technology was extremely high, it came down to a sort of basic humanity in the end, and people just really enjoying what they're doing. And I think sort of the whole thing was sensational, yeah.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Good. Did you enjoy?
Yes, I did.
Do you want to speak?
No?
I thought it was incredible. I was blown away by all of the stuff that was going on in space that I had no idea about. And I thought the IMAX and the 3D effects were just mind-blowing.
And was there any particular highlight?
Well, I was very freaked out at the beginning when things started coming at me, but all of the shots from space of the Earth and the stuff with the astronauts moving outside, you know, on the arm and then through space with that jetpack thing, that was incredible.
And did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was great. Oh, it was so lifelike, and it got you a bit dizzy at some stages, but you just had to close your eyes for a couple of seconds and kind of just relax. But then, you know, it was great.
And which did you think most of, the views inside the station or the people or the views of the Earth?
Well, the views of the Earth were really impressive. Learning about the astronauts were great, and that was brilliant, but I was really concentrating
right.
on, like, they were showing Africa, you know, Mexico. It was brilliant. It was great.
Would you like to go up there?
Oh, for sure. Very inspiring, I have to say.
I'm with Peter McMillan from the Museum of Melbourne. What did you think of it, Peter?
Oh, I thought it was magnificent. I mean, short of actually being on board, I thought the blast-off sequences of both were just absolutely amazing. The whole theatre shook. You could feel it.
Did you duck at the Baikonur Cosmodrome when that debris came flying towards us?
Yeah, I just thought it was. I thought it was amazing. I just hadn't anticipated that we'd be that close to launch. And then, of course, the other thing that I loved was just the view from space, looking down from the shuttles, was just absolutely brilliant. And then if you look closely, right at the end, you saw Andy Thomas's name as well. That was pretty special, because we didn't actually... We saw him in the film, but nobody actually said hello to him or anything.
What did you think of the movie?
Oh, I thought it was a fantastic film. I was really impressed with the way that you could see the real detail of what was going on in the space station, and I think it's a really realistic portrayal of what goes on up there. Very exciting, very dynamic, and yeah, it's worth getting along to see.
And what was a highlight for you?
I think the funny things that happen up there with popcorn and things not going quite the right way, the way that people would expect. So that's funny. All the weightlessness things are funny, yeah.
Did you enjoy the movie?
Yes, I thought it was amazing. Some of the things they can do in space that I didn't realise. Unbelievable.
And what were some of these?
Just the way they put the space shuttle together in space and the workings of it, how long they're in space for in such a confined area.
And would you like to go up there yourself?
It'd be a bit scary, but yes, I wouldn't pass up the chance.
And that was comments from the audience as they came out of that new movie, Space Station 3D, the movie that's narrated by Tom Cruise and produced by Tony Myers. And you've been listening then to the final in a series of three space show programs celebrating the work of Canadian filmmaker Tony Myers. We heard extracts from her IMAX films Hail Columbia, The Dream is Alive, Blue Planet and Destiny in Space. Now, Tony Myers' latest film, as I said, is showing now at the IMAX Cinema in Raftown Street, Carlton. And this documentary series was written and produced by Andrew Rennie, with technical work by Alan Walker.
If you have trouble reading, that's something you can fix.
1-300-655-06.
If street directories leave you weak, if writing a letter makes you freak, if filling in forms can take a week, that's something you can fix.
1-300-655-06.
That's the Reading Writing Hotline.
1-300-655-06.
This is Earth and Sky for Saturday, June 22nd. A listener writes, when did people first figure out how large Earth is?
The first fairly accurate measurement of the size of the Earth was made many centuries ago. It relied on observations of the Sun around this time of year. We've just passed the June solstice, the day on which the Sun takes its northernmost path across the sky for the year.
On the day of the solstice in the ancient city of Syene in Egypt, the Sun was said to shine directly down into water wells exactly at local noon. Syene was located along the Tropic of Cancer, the imaginary line on a map marking the northernmost point on Earth at which the Sun can be seen directly overhead. Thus, at Syene, the Sun passed overhead at noon on the day of the June solstice.
Meanwhile, the Sun never appeared exactly overhead as seen from Alexandria, about 800 kilometers or 500 miles to the north. Early Greek scientists measured the position of the Sun at noon on the day of the solstice in Alexandria and found it to be about 7 degrees south of overhead. Over 2,000 years ago, they used this information and some simple mathematics to estimate Earth's circumference at about 38,000 kilometers or 24,000 miles.
And that's remarkably close to today's satellite measurements. With thanks to the National Science Foundation, we're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
Hi there. I'm Ed Monsper, and if you like my kind of jazz, come to the Jazz Band Ball on this station, 88.3 Southern FM.
The Jazz Band Ball, every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock.
Now, one of the things that people have wondered about for many, many years is what effect does spaceflight have on the physiology of both humans and animals? And that's gone on right from even before the first people went up. They said that people would choke on their own vomit because there would be no gravity to hold it down. Quite oblivious to the fact that kids like myself used to hang upside down on the monkey bars for hours at a time, and we didn't choke. But anyway, they then found out that there's effects on the bone, that muscles waste away, and all sorts of things. But one of the things they haven't done until recently is study the effects on sperm. If we're going to ever go and live in space, we'll need to know whether or not zero gravity and radiation in space has any effect on human sperm, or if we're going to bring animals into space and form cities with growing animals and so on, we need to know that too. Well, rest assured, NASA is on the research, and Tony Phillips, who presents science at NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, filed this report about sperm in space. He called it floating fertility.
Things are different in space. Humans sleep upside down, hot air doesn't rise, boiling water doesn't froth, bones weaken, muscles atrophy, and an ordinary sneeze can send you flying. The list goes on and on. Now scientists have added one more item, a surprising and important one, to the list of things that work oddly when the familiar feel of gravity vanishes. Sperm. According to Joseph Tash, a NASA-supported physiologist at the University of Kansas Medical Center, sperm behave differently in the near-weightless environment of space than they do on Earth. Whether these changes will impair or aid fertility, he doesn't yet know. But, says Tash, it's becoming increasingly clear that in outer space, fertilization of humans, of animals, and even of plants will very likely be affected. The puzzling behavior of spacefaring sperm first attracted attention in 1988 when the German researcher U. Engelmann sent samples of bull sperm into orbit aboard a European Space Agency rocket. His goal in that and a later experiment was merely to determine whether changes in gravity affected the motility or movement of sperm. He found that it did. The tiny cells appeared to move better in a low-gravity environment. Good news, it seemed, for fertilization, which is closely tied to sperm motility. Perhaps making babies would actually be easier in space. But, says Tash, who has studied the sperm of sea urchins on board NASA shuttle flights, it's not so simple. Sperm movement, he explains, begins with a process called phosphorylation, a chemical reaction widely used by cells to control their own activities. In phosphorylation, an enzyme changes the functioning of a protein within a cell. This sets off a kind of domino chain reaction that starts some type of activity, like causing the tails of sperm to move, and to propel the sperm cell forward. On Earth, the tail movement is halted or modified when a second enzyme, known as a protein phosphatase, kicks in. In microgravity, Tash found that the second enzymes don't do their job within the normal time period. Although his results may explain why sperm move faster in space, they don't necessarily imply that fertilization will be easier. After all, if one enzyme isn't activated properly, perhaps others will be affected too. Many enzyme reactions play a role in the fertilization process. For example, to ready the sperm to insert the DNA into the egg. Says Tash, if enzyme processes are being altered by gravity, and they are, you can't even guess at the effect on fertilization until you've studied more than just sperm movement. Tash's initial research took place on board shuttle missions STS-81 and STS-84. Those were part of the Mir docking flights, he explains, and there was no room for microscopes. Although we wanted to, we could not actually look at the sperm motility itself. As it turned out, doing without microscopes led to unexpected benefits. They were forced to concentrate instead on the proteins that are connected with the process. As a result, says Tash, we were able to identify previously unknown proteins in the sperm tail that are very tightly coupled to the initiation of sperm movement. More recently, Tash has studied the effects on sperm of hypergravity, that is, greater than normal gravity. Working with a centrifuging microscope in Germany, he was able to examine activated sea urchin sperm under conditions up to 5G, that is, 5 times normal Earth gravity. His findings expanded on the results of the shuttle experiments. On the shuttle, Tash explained, researchers examined the proteins by activating millions of immotile sperm and then using antibodies, looking at the way the proteins had changed 30 and 60 seconds later. With the centrifuging microscope, we were actually taking measurements of individual sperm cells. Following each of the unique wrigglings of hundreds of individual sperm, Tash found that sperm motility begins to deteriorate at as little as 1.3 Gs. And he found, in hypergravity, fertilization itself is reduced by a full 50%. As in microgravity, these effects seem to be driven by changes in phosphorylation. It's actually astonishing that something as tiny as sperm could be affected by gravity. Physicists, says Tash, might argue that the size of molecules critical to sperm movement are not big enough to be sensitive to gravity. But, he points out, the head of a sperm is about the same size as statoliths in plants, small floating granules that help plants tell up from down. Gravity may in fact affect things that are even smaller. Researchers, says Tash, are now beginning to find evidence that even the individual proteins that form the structures of the sperm tail may be sensitive to gravity changes. No one knows exactly how gravity affects cells. It may have to do with the cytoskeleton, the structure that gives a cell its shape. Proteins that send signals are often physically connected with the cytoskeleton, says Tash. Perhaps, he says, there is a mechanism in which the gravitational forces on the sperm head are somehow transmitted into the cytoskeleton, which then affects the signaling pathways that alter movement. This is a puzzle humans need to solve if we plan to spend much time in space. Ultimately, our exploration of the cosmos may rely on the ability of many species to reproduce in microgravity, not only humans, but also animals and greenhouse plants. For NASA, says Tash, the basic underlying question is, do changes in gravitational force affect the ability of species to reproduce? Increasingly, the answer seems to be yes. It's an area, he says, that requires a lot more attention. Editor's note. Why does Tash use sea urchin sperm for his experiments? Despite the unusual source, sperm and sperm movement are universal in the animal kingdom, Tash says. Sea urchin sperm is used because there is less variation from one urchin to another than there is among humans or other mammals. Sea urchin sperm can also survive pre-launch delays better than many other species. This story was written by Karen Miller and read by Tony Phillips. It's presented by Science at NASA and the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center. To find more Science at NASA stories on the Internet, please visit science.nasa.gov.
And our thanks to Tony Phillips for filing that rather interesting story. And who said the astronauts don't have the right stuff? Now, as talking about something else that's the right sort of stuff is asteroids. Now, asteroids, it's a rock floating around in space, bit debris left over from the formation of the solar system in most cases. And once in a while, they come past the Earth and even have been known to hit the Earth. And a case in point is an asteroid about the size of a football field hurled past the Earth at the end of June, missing what could have been a catastrophic collision by a mere 130,000 kilometres. That's a long way, you say, but then you realise, hey, that's a third of the distance to the Moon. The miss is one of the nearest ever recorded for an object of that size. The asteroid would have caused considerable loss of life had it struck the Earth in a populated area, said Grant Stokes, the principal investigator for the Lincoln Near Earth Asteroid Research Project, whose New Mexico Observatory spotted the object last month. The energy release would have been of the magnitude of a large nuclear weapon, said Stokes. The asteroid was not detected until 3 days after it sped past the Earth on June the 14th. Now, when such asteroids are detected, they are usually spotted far from the Earth when they are approaching or on their way out. The asteroid, which has provisionally been named 2002 MN, was travelling at more than 36,000 kilometres per hour relative to the Earth when it was spotted. Now, asteroids the size of 2002 MN are estimated to hit the Earth about every 100 to several hundred years, causing local damage but no disaster to the planet's ecosystem. Light in weight, but with a diameter of between 50 and 120 metres, 2002 MN was big enough to cause the kind of devastation wrecked in Siberia in 1908, when an asteroid that exploded above Tunguska flattened nearly 2,000 square kilometres of forest. The folks at Earth and Sky have more details about the Tunguska event.
This is Earth and Sky for Sunday, June 30th. A listener writes, I've read about a mystery explosion in Russia in the 20th century, as powerful as an atom bomb, but decades before the first atom bomb. Do you know anything about this?
On today's date in 1908, a fireball did indeed streak across the daytime sky over Siberia. Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above the Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site, but no crater was ever found.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations for the Tunguska explosion. Some were pretty wild, such as the encounter of Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
But the truth might be fantastic enough. In all likelihood, a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30th, 1908. If it were an asteroid, it might have been about a third as big as a football field, moving at about 15 kilometers or 10 miles per second. Because the explosion took place so long ago, we might never know for certain what caused it.
But we do know that space objects can collide with Earth. Now, scientists routinely search for objects whose paths might cross ours. With thanks to the National Science Foundation, we're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
And John Howard says it can't happen. An asteroid hitting the Earth. My gosh. Well, it can, and it nearly did just a few days ago. One who has studied asteroids is astronaut Harrison Smith. He started his life as a geologist, and his interest in geology took him to the moon. In fact, he became the very last person to set foot on the moon. And that was way back in 1972. And he's going to be setting foot here in Melbourne. In fact, he's here right now. And he'll be giving a public lecture tomorrow night. This will be at La Trobe University in Bundoora. It'll be held in the West Lecture Theatre. It's a free public lecture starting at 6 p.m. The title of the talk is My Trip to the Moon and How It Happened to Me. No bookings are necessary, but I advise you to get there early. This is the West Lecture Theatre, La Trobe University in Bundoora, starting at 6 p.m. to hear Harrison Smith, the last moonwalker. Someone else is giving a talk on July 22nd at the Space Association. That's in the Richmond Public Library on Church Street. July 22nd at 6:30 p.m. will be Warwick Jones. His topic is space insurance and finance. And you'll find that, yes, you can insure satellites. You can't get public liability insurance, but you can get insurance to launch rockets and satellites. And he has all the gin on that. Well, you've been listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie and Alan Walker. And in a few moments, we're going to pass over to David Fletcher. We'll be back next Wednesday after the 7 o'clock news.